From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
William Cooper is my guest. He's an attorney and a national columnist whose work can be seen in the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Newsweek, San Francisco Chronicle, Chicago Sun-Times, Huffington Post, and lots of other places. His new book is called How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System. William Cooper, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Great to be here, Gary. Thank you.
So it does seem like we're very, very divided in our country right now. How did we get so divided?
Well, I think it's a combination of long-term trends and realities and some short-term trends as well. In my opinion, you know, people in general tend to be biased and partisan. Not everybody, but it's a certain part of human nature that some people will be. And our political system with two political parties only, as opposed to a more diverse set of parties, I think compounds that. You've got two juggernauts battling every day. And then when you add the internet and social media on top of that, I think you get the results we're seeing today.
Well, I heard what you said there and read about it in your book about the two-party system being ineffective. But I've also heard that a splintering of parties is bad. That can lead to like a minority rule, which is essentially what we have in the Supreme Court right now. And, you know, I guess a historic example would be Woodrow Wilson. I mean, he was the candidate who was least popular, but won the presidency because there were three political parties that year with the Bull Moose Party.
I think it's a great point. You're right. There's no solution, no single swoop that you can just make a change and everything gets better and where you'd want it to be. I think with the two-party system, what you have, in my view, you've got the increased tribalism, right? The fewer the tribes, the worse the tribalism generally. And there's also just a real diminution of the debate. I mean, really important things, if they're not on one platform or the other, don't get discussed, don't get backing. And society benefits really from a diverse marketplace of ideas. You could go too far and have too many parties. It's also true that more parties would not solve everything. People are still people. You would still have all sorts of challenges. Gridlock could still be an issue. But to me, the foundation of society would be benefited by having more voices that actually mattered.
But what about the idea of a minority rule as a result of a lot of parties? Is that not a possibility, a fact, or whatever?
It absolutely would be on the table. And it'd be a good example of how there'd be pluses and minuses with whatever system you had. A robust multi-party system where you had instances of the plurality winner governing would not, in my mind, necessarily be a bad thing compared to what we have today.
Right. I mean, things are bad, so we're obviously looking for solutions to them. And in your book, How America Works and Why It Doesn't, William Cooper, you kind of hold both parties responsible. You say that the Democrats and the Republicans are equally divisive and devoted to their causes without reason. But it does seem to me, not because I'm a Democrat, but just looking at it objectively, that the Democrats are currently more engaged in truth-telling than the Republicans are. They lie and then they stick to their lie. I mean, I can give you an example. The inflation rate is currently, I think, 2.89% or something like that. But on Face the Nation the other day, Governor Kevin Stitt of Oklahoma was on, and he said that the reason we have 20% inflation under the Biden-Harris administration right now is blah, 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 as if that were a fact. And then later on, he said President Harris's policies have led to a 20% increase in inflation. And he also said that Harris was a communist and so on, which is something we hear Republicans say over and over again. That is, I think the things that I heard of the Democratic convention were more fact-based than that.
You'll be very happy to know that I wholeheartedly agree with you, Gary. And what I say in the book is both parties contribute to the problem. The Republicans are a lot worse. That's my view. So we are on the same page when it comes to facts and being accurate. Democrats are better. The Republicans, a huge part of their platform as a party under Trump as their champion, is undermining the most essential principles of our government relating to the peaceful transfer of power. So I do not equate them as equals. But I do think if you look across the landscape, you can find blame to be apportioned appropriately on both sides.
Well, how could that be? How could it be proportionate on both sides if one side is clearly not using a truth-based basis for their platform?
Well, one side is really bad, the Republicans. But
yes.
The other side isn't perfect, right? There's still things that the other side could do better. I think that particularly in the extreme portions of the Democratic Party, you have voices advocating for policies that wouldn't work, that would be counterproductive. So that's an example where you wouldn't say one side's terrible, the other side's perfect. You would say one side's really, really bad. The other side has its problems too. And the underlying, you know, issue to me that afflicts both parties is tribalism, where both sides are looking at things through a lens of, if I like these facts, I'm going to embrace them. If they support my tribe, I'm all in. If I don't like these facts, I'm going to diminish them or even reject them. Republicans are worse, but I don't think they're the only ones doing that.
Well, okay, but... So within the idea of a tribalism thing, I mean, it is true that there's something weird that has transpired in the last 20 years that wasn't there before. I mean, I can remember when President Kennedy was elected, when President Johnson was elected, when President Nixon was elected. They became the president of the United States, and we put their picture up in our classrooms, and nobody said, who are these guys? And they have no right to be there. And there was no opposition to their leadership throughout their, at least their first 4 years in office. I mean, there's a loyal opposition, but not a complete standstill where we won't let them do anything or do anything that makes them look good because we have to get our guy in as soon as possible. I remember in 2008, I was working as a teacher at a middle school, and President Obama wanted to speak to kids on the over the television the next morning so that all the kids around the country could watch the president live speaking to them. And our principal said, we'll have to record it and air it later after we view it to make sure that the president hasn't said anything that will upset the parents of our students. And I just couldn't believe that. I mean, the president of the United States wants to talk to you, and we have to filter it.
Totally agree. That's ridiculous.
But yet that's the mindset now. So like it's even when a person is president, they are still either one party or the other rather than the president of all the American people, even though every president says I am the president for all the American people, except for President Trump. Even Nixon, you know, considered himself the president of all the American people. And if he hadn't gotten caught doing all the terrible things he did, he would have served his 8 years. And then there would have been another president. Yeah.
No, I agree. I think you're articulating very well what I'm saying. I think that we as a country, ideally, what you would have is everybody agrees on the rules, you know, peaceful transfer of power, democracy, judicial review, and we hold free and fair elections that people respect. And then governments reorganized consistent with the vote of the people that get the jobs govern. And then there's robust, good faith, honest debate, opposition, and we go about our business. And what we have now instead is these two tribes that are very, very at odds in, you know, really fundamental ways. And they're trying to undercut each other in ways that I think harm everyone, right? If you're, when you take it too far, it harms everybody, and that's where I think we find ourselves today.
It's almost like has replaced religion in American culture. That is, if you're a believer, then nothing anybody can say can stop you from being a believer. And if you're not a believer, nothing anybody says can make you believe. But politics is supposed to be a thing where you listen and judge based on policies. Now, I think that
Absolutely.
the Democrats are more inclined to do that than the Republicans, but you think that it's both parties doing that.
Yeah, I think the Democrats have definitely, in general, they're much better than the Republicans in terms of their respect for adherence to our principles, willingness to compromise. I think Joe Biden, his impulses are, traditional, and he respects the system, whereas Republicans are much quicker to be willing to toss all that aside to get what they want. So it's not equal in the sense of culpability. But I do think the Democrats have gone too far. I think they have made mistakes. So I don't think it's one side is guilty as sin and the other side is pure and innocent.
But it's not equitable. That is, I think the Republicans do it much more because their objections are not fact-based. And the fact that we no longer care about truth, that is for the Republican half of the country, truth is no longer an issue. It's okay to not be truthful, starting with
I
the
think a lot
alternative
of them.
facts. Yeah.
I don't think all Republicans, but I think a lot of them. I think the Donald Trump's core supporters, that's true. And that's a really big problem. And perhaps the most disturbing part of all of this to me is not just Trump himself, but the fact that he did all the things he did as president. And it culminated in him trying to overturn a presidential election, which is unfathomable before that. And yet he emerges from that as the Republicans' champion. So they don't care about facts. And they not only do not care about facts, but they don't care about somebody who really went after the key essential principle of our entire system. The premise of our democracy is the peaceful transfer of power after an election. Everything flows from that. That's the starting point. He tried to reverse it and they don't care. And that's really disturbing.
Now, do you think that's because of tribalism or money?
I think it's much more about tribalism than money. I think Donald Trump has tens of millions of supporters throughout the country who love him and do what, believe in him and support him, irrespective of how the dollars happen to be flowing. I do think money is a problem generally, but I think the Trump mania is much more of a psychological phenomenon rooted in tribalism than it is just an example of money.
When I was listening to Governor Kevin Stitt the other day, he also said that deregulation is what America needs. That seems to be a, that's always been a Republican. The ideal, right, in the old days was that Republicans believed in small government and government staying out of people's lives, and Democrats believed in a large government that had services and support. But now those lines are very blurred because certainly anti-abortion laws do not equate with a small government.
Yeah. Very incoherent.
Yes, how did those lines get so blurred? It used to be pretty simple. I mean, you would just look at a. Well, I'll let you answer.
Yeah, I mean, a lack of coherence, a lack of firm intellectual underpinnings for either side's views, and in particular the Republicans, it's a sign, again, it goes back to, I'm using the term tribalism, but you could also say partisanship, just extreme tribalism, where when all you care about is that your side is good and the other side is bad, and you're interpreting everything through that lens, coherent philosophical principles disappear, right? What matters is, was it your person? Was it your side? Or the other side. And when that's what is driving people to participate. That's what's the foundation of their views. Being consistent with what you said yesterday doesn't matter. Being consistent with what you used to stand for years ago doesn't matter.
Well, what, give some examples then of where Democrats do the same thing. I mean, solid examples of where they do the same
thing.
So
I think a good solid example is when I'm very opposed to Donald Trump. I'm a huge Trump critic, but I did not think the evidence was anywhere remotely close to supporting the idea that he conspired with Vladimir Putin to hack into the DMC email servers and spill, you know, all those emails in the election. I didn't think the facts anywhere near supported it. And yet it was a huge multi-year frenzy where Democrats in office, in the press, and so on, jumped on that bandwagon and believed it and used it as a tool to undermine Trump's presidency. I think that was a mistake. And I think an example where the facts didn't matter. The facts didn't support it, yet it was a huge movement for years.
Well, there was undoubtedly Russian interference in the election. That's a fact as well, right?
Yes.
And there's also undoubtedly the fact that Trump benefited from that interference.
I think there's definitely a likelihood that what they did with those servers helped Trump. I don't know if it tipped the scales in his favor in swing states and gave him the election or not, but I do think that's true. But going from there and saying what was said repeatedly, that Trump and Putin conspired in cyberspace to hack into the DNC servers, that they did it together, that's a huge leap that wasn't warranted.
Well, you spend some time in your book, How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System, William Cooper. You spend some time with each of the indictments against Trump, the cases that are either going or have been thrown out or whatever. Maybe you could address some of those for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. And, you know, one of my concerns about the future in this country is that I do think there's a fraying of the line between politics and criminal justice. And I think that's a very dangerous line to blur. You know, for example, if a Republican prosecutor in Delaware brings trumped up charges against Biden 6 months after he leaves office, that would be terrible. And I think most people would, you know, on the Democratic side would find that terrible. And I'm just worried about that race to the bottom. And so one of the things that I did in the book was evaluate each of Trump's cases. And there's a continuum. On one side of the continuum, I think, is the New York case brought by Alvin Bragg, where I don't think that case would have been brought by would have been brought against a normal citizen. I think that was a case where the case was brought to hurt Trump, and that was the objective, and it was therefore a mistake. And then on the other side of the continuum is Jack Smith's case, prosecuting Trump for what he did surrounding the 2020 presidential election, not just January 6th, but the months-long campaign that Trump engaged in to reverse the results. And that case was not only justified, but it's essential that it be brought to be a deterrent for future presidents. We need to draw a really sharp line in the sand that says that behavior is criminal and not okay. And if we don't do that, we invite it in the future. And if that becomes a common occurrence, you know, in a country of overstatement, I think it's an understatement to say it would threaten our democracy if that's common, if Trump's behavior becomes common for incumbent presidents. So I try to draw distinctions between them and not just jump on the, you know, pro-Trump, they're all terrible, or anti-Trump, get them at any cost. I think sifting through it and making judgments on each one is important.
All right, but what if Trump truly is a threat to democracy, which the evidence shows he is? And what if a huge faction of Americans don't care and still want to elect him, even if it would mean the end of democracy and of voting? You won't have to vote again just this one time. It'll be the last time you'll have to vote. Statements like that. Those are scary things, And so in the name of democracy, you do anything you can to stop him from running for president again. Doesn't that seem like a noble, patriotic act?
It's a great question. I think if it was, if you clearly had an option that was effective, it'd be a different story. But I think it's very unlikely that Trump's conviction in New York is going to keep him out of office. I actually think there's a strong correlation from the data I've seen that when unfair prosecutions go against Trump, I think the Mueller, as I already explained with the Russia, I think Mueller, that really galvanized a lot of his supporters. When his indictments came down initially in New York, he was actually very close with Ron DeSantis. It's hard to even imagine that.
Yeah.
And then his numbers really went up. And I don't know if that's causation or correlation, but I think it's very unlikely he's in jail, physically prevented from being president. So I just don't think it's workable. And I think it's at least as likely it helps him as his martyr, right? His afactual, you know, counterfactual thesis that he's this, you know, witch hunt and all of that. I think it actually resonates with his voters. So it's just as likely to propel him into office as it is to keep him out of office. And then you've got all the knock-on effects that I am concerned about, right? If a Republican goes after Biden and then, you know, a Democrat goes after this person and it just doesn't stop, who's ever going to want to be president?
Oh, well, you know, that's a very good question. Why would anybody want to be in public office?
Because we're already there, aren't we, Gary?
They do make it miserable for people who run for office. But let's look at some of the historic things that have happened and why Trump is still where he is. For instance, when Gary Hart had a girl sitting on his lap on a boat, that was the end of his career forever. Now I suddenly can't
remember. John Edwards.
Yeah, John Edwards. Or the candidate who raised his voice. Now I suddenly can't remember his name. Who was?
Howard Dean.
Yeah, Howard Dean. He raised his voice. End of his political career.
Yes, I remember that.
And yet the Access Hollywood tape made no difference in Trump's popularity. Convictions for sexual assault have made zero impact, seemingly, on his popularity. The fact that it's still close seems just absolutely baffling.
Couldn't agree more. It's very disturbing, very shocking. I totally agree. Those are great examples. Where are we as a country, and why have things changed so much that a man who takes the old sins that used to dispositively eliminate politicians, multiply them, square them, and if anything, it appears to help? That is a question for the American people. That's not a question for Donald Trump. He is who he is. That's a question for the American people. Why do tens of millions of people strongly support somebody who's like that? I don't know the answer. My best thesis is the tribalism has gone so rampant that, as you said, facts just don't matter.
When you look back at history and see, you know, Nixon's resignation, for instance, which just was 50th anniversary of just passed, or Clinton's impeachment for the grew out of the Starr report, which was originally about something completely different and yet stumbled upon this other thing. What role did those particular events play in creating our current divisions?
It's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I think those are really good examples of, you know, with Nixon, he resigned, you know, compare that to what Trump would do in similar circumstances, right? He'd fundraise on it. His next email to supporters would be bragging about it.
Would you have advised Nixon to resign or to stick it through impeachment?
If I were his advisor wanting him to stay, I would have advised him not to resign. And the downside for Nixon, worst case scenario, is he leaves office because he's convicted by the Senate by 2/3. And, you know, that's not all that much worse than resigning. And there's upside as he gets to keep this job. If we were in today's climate, I think there'd be a 5-minute conversation and they'd start laughing about it and say, of course, we're not going to quit. Why would we? But the country's changed a lot. And the Nixon would resign for his sins, but Donald Trump carries the torch as the champion, you know, proudly bearing his sins, is a sign of how much the country's changed. I actually think another example that's more recent of how much the country's changed is comparing 9/11 to COVID. So in 2001, 9/11 happened, and there was a period of several months. It didn't last permanently, but there was this period of, you know, a good number of months where there was a lot of unity in the country. There felt like there was a common threat, common concern. Bush's approval ratings were very high for quite some time. And the country said, look, I know we disagree about domestic politics, but this threatens all of us. And they banded together. 20 years later, COVID comes around. It's different, but it has some similarities in that it's a common threat. It's something that all Americans have to face with. And instead of banding together and rallying around our leaders to address this threat, we splintered along the exact same party lines that we do every day. And it actually was the worst splintering, the most vociferous and irrational splintering when we faced, you know, the biggest threat. So what happened in those 20 years that caused such a dramatic difference? And my thesis again is that the key ingredient that changed was the internet, social media, and the fragmentation of our media system, where people live in ecosystems where facts don't matter, but what they're receiving, you know, whether it's accurate or inaccurate, that really governs people's thinking.
Well, do you think that that's partially due to, so after we had this wonderful unity, and it was actually like a world unity, I mean, the whole world was behind America after 9/11, that Bush, George W. Bush, kind of squandered that unity by was launching a war on Iraq, which had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11.
Yes. I've given you very long answers this morning, so I'm just going to keep that as yes.
I want to ask you about conspiracy theories. In the 1960s, after the assassination of President Kennedy, at first there was the Warren Commission and people accepted it. And then in 1967 or so, Mark Lane published a book called Rush to Judgment, and people began to question. And it was also the time of the accelerating war in Vietnam. People began to question for the first time the government, question authority became a button. And it became a left wing, primarily a left wing point of view that there were conspiracies, that there was a deep state that was controlling us. And there was a movie, The Parallax View, by Ellen J. Pakula, a new Hollywood kind of liberal idea that we are being controlled and that there's conspiracies everywhere. And now conspiracy is like a huge right wing thing. How did it change from left wing to right wing? Do you have any idea?
That's a great question. I don't know. I find conspiracies very fascinating. You know, just you find the same people who are very rational in their everyday life, right? If the milk starts to get low, they go to the store and buy milk. If they need more gas, they go fill up the tank. And they function well in their everyday lives. And we all know lots of people like that. You see them at the water cooler at the office. And then you start talking politics with them and they sound like, you know, they just got dropped off by a Martian or something. And they're just completely in another universe. And yes, the right wing certainly has a really strong hold on that, being the winner there. I'm not sure how it shifted, though, from left to right.
It's strange to me that
Yeah, I
that
agree. It's a
happened.
good point. I hadn't thought about that shift, but I think that's exactly right.
Well, you did say something in your book, How America Works and Why It Doesn't, William Cooper, that really irked me. I hope you don't mind if
Oh, good.
I talk
Yes,
to you
please.
about it. You have a wonderful section in your book about the problems of education, which are clear. I mean, it is really clear that a large number of Americans don't know anything. And I think there are a lot of reasons that that's the case. But one thing you said, and you kind of slipped it in as though it were a fact, was that teachers' unions protect underperformers. And that's something I hear a lot from people who don't understand what tenure is and why it's needed. I mean, there's absolutely a process for getting rid of an underperforming teacher. And if that is an objective and not subjective analysis of their job performance. But I've been an educator for 30 years, and I've never seen the union protect an underperforming teacher. But I have seen, and I personally have had to stand up to administrators for what I believed in to the benefit of my students. And without tenure, I could not do that.
I think it's a good point, and that chapter was intended to give several examples. So I have this whole book about why America's not working. I felt like I had to have a chapter where I actually get into the policy outcomes and show, that all of this dysfunction and irrationality, much of which we've talked about today, has consequences, real world consequences, education, mass incarceration, the environment, excessive inequality, and so on. And so it only got one chapter. So in some cases, it was cursory, and I concede that. My sense on that particular topic is that I could have written a whole book about that, just that topic. And so I didn't give it the, on the one hand, here's the positives, on the other hand, here's the negatives, treatment that it deserves. And I probably should have given at least another sentence, to round it out in that context. You make a good point. My sense, and I'm not an expert, and you are, my sense is that teachers' unions do a lot of good, and they protect people, and they serve a really important purpose. And I'm a big believer in collective bargaining because part of a free market, let the employees do what they want freely and band together and get the, get their rights vindicated. But I also think there are negative consequences to unionization at times, and that I would suspect throughout the country, perhaps not in every district, but throughout the country, there are a number of examples where teachers are underperforming, but because of the union, they're protected.
I think, there's if a teacher were to actually break any kind of law or rule, there's no union would protect them. They are immediately fired. But if but I I have a I remember a principal that just did not like my teaching and harassed me in her entire tenure that she was my principal. She was wrong and I was right, and I outlasted her and continued teaching well beyond the time that she tried to get me to quit because she didn't want me. But I was doing good, even though
The
she
union
didn't want
helped. Yeah.
me. She could
And
not.
there are also, would it be fair to say there are also examples at times where a teacher's not breaking the law or violating rules, but they're underperforming, they're not passionate about their job, they're not going the extra mile to help students, but there's nothing that can be done where in an alternative context, you could get somebody who's more excited and passionate about the job. I mean, I would think that does happen as well. Is that
I'm
fair?
not going to say it doesn't happen, but I would say that it's unlikely to happen because every 2 years a teacher has to be evaluated, and the administration does the evaluation. And if they say you are not performing, you don't have the passion, you're not doing what you need to do, they can give you a negative evaluation. If you get a negative evaluation, then they have to put you on a plan of assistance, which means you must improve. And if you don't improve, then they can escalate that another level toward firing you. So, in other words, it's not like a teacher can never be fired. They must do their job. And if they're not doing their job well, then they get a negative evaluation. And if the teacher fails to improve, then that would escalate to another level. So, what would have to be determined is, are they truly non-performing, or is it a subjective view of them? No, they're not performing to what the principal wants them to do. I mean, I've had principals who want every teacher to do exactly the same thing in every room at exactly the same time, which is unreasonable, I believe. I think the instances are probably could be equated with dead people voting, or other things that people say. Well, this happens all the time when it doesn't. It might
Well,
happen.
I'm working with my publisher on a second edition, and I will take your comment to heart and I'll go look at that section. So thank
Oh,
you.
good. Thank you. I win. All right. Wonderful. That's all I needed to know. No, I don't have to. No, it's the interesting thing about your book is that every page has us scratching our heads about the things that you are saying, and that's one of the great things about how America works and why it doesn't. So let me ask you, William Cooper, about another thing that you said that irked me, but I can't deny that it's probably true, and that is the Second Amendment. So those of us who would like to see guns controlled don't want to see speech controlled. So if we support one amendment, how can we turn our backs on another one? Is this essentially what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, that's fair.
So let me ask you this. In the Constitution, as it was written, it also said slavery was fine and go ahead and have them. But we changed that. And it also said that only men who owned property could vote, but we went ahead and changed that. So why can't we change the interpretation of the Second Amendment to say you can have weapons, but you can't have assault weapons?
Well, we changed the two examples that you gave with slavery and voting. We passed constitutional amendments to change them, and we absolutely could do that with the Second Amendment. And I would be right in the front lines supporting that. I think that would be wonderful if we did. So those are two very different things. Changing by constitutional amendment, which is the most legitimate way you can change the Constitution, head and shoulders above every other mechanism there is. And then judicial interpretation, where you've got whatever the majority of the Supreme Court thinks, that's the Constitution, and that's extremely different. So I think, on the Second Amendment, I don't agree with the court's interpretation. I think it was too broad, but I also don't agree with people who would interpret it into a nullity. I think it is important for the judicial branch to function in an even-handed way. I think that's what our system is set up for. Let the Congress and the president affect the people's will. They get voted into office where judges sit for life. And so I think it's important to have a coherent interpretive philosophy from our judges. So I wouldn't want a broad First Amendment, as you said, and then a very narrow second. I just don't who I don't want to imbue judges with a monopoly on wisdom in that way.
The Supreme Court, as it stands today, is it's there because of Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, and also because some judges who could have resigned who didn't resign when they could have and died instead. But if it's if three of the justices got on the court by lying to Congress, and they did, they said they had no intention of changing Roe v. Wade, and then they changed it. Is that okay? Why is that okay?
I see it a little bit differently. I think that when you go before Congress, I think when the opposition party asks you questions about hot button issues, the way all the nominees, and I would include Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor and Jackson, Ketanji Jackson in this category, you get very lawyerly. When it's your side, you answer very robustly and you wax eloquently on things. And then when you get pressed on things like that, they get lawyerly. And if you look at what they said, they said it is the settled law of the land, right? They didn't say I won't overturn it. They said it's the settled law of the land. There is jurisprudence at the Supreme Court, a very long line of jurisprudence that says you can overturn settled law under these criteria. And that's how Roe was overturned. So was it being upfront? Was it being honest in a practical sense? No, but it was not technically inaccurate. And I think they were doing what the justices do. I think the second you've got a Republican president and a Republican Senate, and you're nominating a judge for the Supreme Court, the game's already over. And I think they were just doing what they do in those hearings.
On the other hand, Democratic Senates and Democratic Congress have approved justices that were not liberal justices. I mean, even if the president was a Republican. And how was Mitch McConnell able to get away with that totally two-faced policy of no, we won't hear merit?
I thought it was a total sham. I think they had technically had the ability to do it, but I thought it was a historic affront to the Constitution and the American people. In 100 years, that's going to be looked at as an abhorrent affront. When the president nominates, the Senate confirms, and for them not to do that was, really, really unfortunate. And in our society, where the Supreme Court has taken to itself over decades the jurisdiction over some of these huge issues, just unbelievably consequential that they did that. So I'm a huge critic of that. And we're watching the consequences now.
Well, what about President Biden's proposed court reforms? What do you think of them, and do they have any chances?
I don't think they have chances. I don't think they have a real chance. That's my sense. I haven't followed it super closely in terms of the sentiment. Term limits is a really interesting question. The Constitution expressly says judges sit for life. So it's against the Constitution to impose term limits. On the other hand, from a practical perspective, they would just be so positive. I mean, I think you alluded to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Not resigning. She was 80 when Obama was president and the Democrats controlled the Senate. There is a straight line from her decision not to resign to Amy Coney Barrett overturning Roe versus Wade with that decisive fifth vote. Clarence Thomas has been on the court for 33 years, right? But I think, again, the way to change that is a constitutional amendment. And I think my sense is it's not going to go anywhere. And packing the Supreme Court doesn't have a constitutional provision preventing it, but it does get a lot of opposition from moderates on both sides.
Right, for sure.
Stephen Breyer, for example, has come out against that. So I don't
If the
see
other
that
side
going
could just
anywhere.
do it, I mean,
Exactly.
they just go back and
Race
forth.
to the bottom. Classic race to the bottom.
Yeah. Well, when we talk about the Constitution was written at a time when, 60 was old, and when the population of America was 11 million people, not 350 million people. So there are so many things that have happened. I mean, when they passed the Second Amendment, they had no idea that there would be assault weapons or that people would suddenly want to shoot everybody I mean, if you'd have said, oh, there's going to be a giant hotel and somebody will get up on the top of this hotel and shoot everybody at a rock concert, I mean, they would say, what's a rock concert?
What's Vegas?
Yeah. So, how do we deal with that reality?
Well, even the great constitutional cheerleader Antonin Scalia conceded that the founders made a mistake by making it too hard to amend the Constitution. If you make it too easy, you basically have no constitution at all because everything's flip-flopping around and the cohesion for society of a set of rules at the highest level that I think is important. So you don't want to just screech too far to the other end of the continuum. But at the same time, in modern day American politics, it's essentially impossible to amend the Constitution. So when, the Supreme Court can play around in the ambiguities, but they're not going to be able to completely, no justice on this court would just completely override the Constitution, right? So we're stuck. I don't see a practical way around it. I mean, maybe the political climate will change in the future where there will be mechanisms for actually mobilizing enough people to amend the Constitution. An amendment to the amendment process could be quite dramatic, for example. But I think right now we are stuck with some of these problems, and it traces back to the founders just making it a little too hard. You don't want to relax it too much, but it's a little too hard to amend the Constitution.
Well, William Cooper, speaking of things that we're stuck in, what about the Electoral College? That seems like that is a huge problem in America. I mean, if a candidate gets 6 million votes in a state, and another candidate gets 6,000,001 votes, then the 6 million votes that this candidate got don't count for anything.
Absolutely. I mean, the basic principle of election that should be the lodestar for all of the subsidiary rules is proportionality. One person, one vote. It's impossible to get that perfect. Elections are huge and complicated, and you have to draw some lines. But that should be the impulse behind all of our rules. One person, one vote across the board. That's what our government is founded on. That's the ethos of the American experiment. And the Electoral College is just light years from that principle in so many different ways. There's a real absurdity, just, a centimeter from all of our noses and not everybody's seeing it, which is our presidential elections come down to a few counties in a few states. There are a few counties in a few states that determine who will be president of the United States. And that is a true absurdity, yet we're so used to it that people seem to forget. They talk about swing states without zooming out and just thinking about how absurd that is. Here we are in California. We have absolutely no impact whatsoever, a state of 30 plus million people, on who our president is.
Because we're a blue state, period.
We're too far blue. Nobody even cares.
Right. I was talking to my uncle who lives in Iowa, and he said, well, I don't see any point in voting because my vote won't mean anything. He's a Democrat.
Yeah.
Is he right?
He's technically right, and it's a shame. Yeah.
So what can we do about it?
It's a great question. I mean, I think it ultimately comes down to the health and vibrancy and functioning of our polity in general needs to get better. We have too many people who are illiterate when it comes to civics. We have too many people who are more concerned that their tribe wins and the other side loses than getting it right for everybody. And I think looking at it from the perspective, not of the government needs to do this or the courts need to do that or these laws need to change, but looking at it from the perspective of the American people ourselves is the place to focus. Not an easy thing to solve, but I think that's where the focus should be.
Well, William Cooper, you've pointed out all these problems in your book. What about some solutions? What can we do?
Yeah, very hard. I mean, the book is definitely long on criticism and short on solution. That was the focus of this book. And I've received a lot of feedback correctly noting that. I mean, to the extent that the book can help, it's just to think about how we're all thinking about these issues and our own biases, our own, I'm as susceptible to it as anyone else. I'm trying to point them out. But if we are thinking about issues reflexively, if we're embracing things that maybe we shouldn't just because they help our story, maybe we can slow down and think about it. And then on a practical perspective, my personal opinion would be to try to support candidates who aren't just flamethrowers. When somebody's throwing a flame in a direction you like, it feels great. But to me, it's an indication that there's a likelihood that candidate's not going to try to solve problems with everybody in mind, but, dive in and be another warrior in the culture wars and things of that nature. So trying to get more moderates and folks thinking about solutions and not just, their next Instagram post to their followers, I think is a practical way. Easy to say, very difficult to do.
Well, there are some issues that you just can't compromise on. And so you affiliate yourself with the party that doesn't compromise on that issue. If you're anti-abortion, you're going to be a follower of Trump. And if you're pro-choice, then you're not going to be. But yeah. What if the death penalty is your, you can't compromise? What's that? What if that's your thing? You are opposed to the death penalty. Which party would you choose? Since neither party, no national candidate has ever come out against the death penalty in the last 20 years.
If that's your issue, you vote Democrat and you hope that they get some Supreme Court justices, because the way to abolish the death penalty in this country is through the Supreme Court, which has happened before, and they've walked it back. But that's how you would do that. One of the problems with this goes back to our conversation about the two-party system. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with the two-party system is if you're one of those Americans, and I have a lot of respect for people like that, they have an issue that's near and dear to their heart. That's what they're focused on. They deeply, deeply care about it. And so they have to choose one or the other. But what happens if you're anti-death penalty? So you have to be Democrat, but then you're in favor of other things that perhaps the Republicans are actually stronger supportive. And I think if we had a more diverse political system, again, wouldn't solve every problem, but would allow people to find a home that made more sense to them. And the people that would help would be people, in my opinion, like you and me, people who are thoughtful and don't just jump on a platform wholesale because it's their team. So that's one thing I think that could help in that area too.
Well, I think a lot of people reading your book would consider themselves exceptions to the rule, like you and me, because they're reading a book.
Makes a minority category, right?
The last thing I want to ask you about is immigration, which has become a big issue for both political parties. And yet the president doesn't have anything to do with immigration. It's a congressional issue, right?
Well, it's a good point. The president certainly has some influence, right? Legislation that addressed immigration, the president could champion and be the most effective voice. The president, of course, would have to sign that legislation for it to go into law. We can't pass anything, so the idea of veto-proof legislation in where the president was involved is off the table, I think, completely.
Yeah.
And then there are a lot of executive actions that the president can take. You know, Trump built his wall, or excuse me, part of his, he claimed to have built his wall, but he only built a small portion of it and spent insane amount of money on that small portion. But the president can do executive things to address the way the, setting up the court system and some of the spending and repurposing immigration agents in certain ways. So you're right that legislation would be required to really tackle it, but I think the president can play a role. And that's a great example to me of how unbelievably dysfunctional our politics and the Republican Party are, where Congress several months ago lined up what would have been a bipartisan improvement to our immigration system, and Donald Trump got involved, made threats, made phone calls, and scuttled the whole thing so that he could have that issue to campaign on. What an unbelievably horrible thing for a leader to do for their country, and yet sort of emblematic of where we are generally.
A wonderful, uplifting book is called How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System. And its author, William Cooper, has been my guest. William Cooper, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. You have a great show, so it's been a real privilege to be on it. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.